Good afternoon. Please be seated. Welcome, everybody, to the afternoon session of the Northern Nevada panel. The first case to be heard this afternoon is Washoe County School District versus Kara White and the Washoe County Principals Association, case number 69385. Ready to proceed?
Good afternoon. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, if I may.
Yes, sir. And you might need to speak up some.
Okay. Is this better?
We're still working on the sound system in the courtroom, so we appreciate you if you can do that.
Good afternoon, if it pleases the court. My name is Christopher B. Reich. I'm Deputy Chief General Counsel for the Washoe County School District, the appellate in this matter. This appeal comes from the Second Judicial District on an order granting the respondent's motion to vacate an arbitration award, which arbitrator Alexander Cohen upheld the district's dismissal of Ms. Kara White, who's represented by the Washoe School Principals Association, the union, in this matter. As a preliminary matter, I must address with the court the scheduling order that was filed February 1st, scheduling this oral argument. In that order, it directs the parties to discuss or focus a discussion on the relationship between the district court's definition of dishonesty, the finding of dishonesty, and 18.1 of the collective bargaining agreement, as well as NRS 391.312 sub C. And that appears to be a typographical error that may have been picked up on the order from the lower court. There is no 391.312 sub C. It's actually prior to 2013, 391.312 sub 1 sub C, which is unprofessional conduct, a grounds for disciplining or dismissing a certified administrator or teacher in the state of Nevada. The numbering's changed. After 13, it was 391.312.97, currently 391.750, but still sub 1 sub C is unprofessional conduct. And I point that out because it appears from the context of the scheduling order that the court may have wanted to discuss sub 1 sub P, which is dishonesty. Another grounds for
that is correct.
Okay, and that's why I want to point out the district's prepared to discuss either one of those provisions. This court must reverse the district court's order and confirm the arbitration award simply because the district court was way beyond its scope of review. And arbitrator Cohen's award is based on substantial evidence, so it's not arbitrary and capricious. He did not exceed his authority under the agreement. And he did not manifestly disregard NRS 391.3116. This court holds a strong public policy favors arbitration in order to avoid the extraneous cost of, or the greater cost of traditional litigation and resources and time. Without reversing this order, I think the precedent of this court holding up that strong policy and the limited review of a district court will be undermined. And rather than having parties that are parties to a contract for binding arbitration, believing that's the end of the road to resolve their problems, it's going to be step one. And the next step is going to be district court for a plenary de novo review and on to the Supreme Court. This court does review these decisions of the district court in granting a vacation or vacating an award or confirming an award de novo. But the district court's review is very limited. And this court holds in the health care plan of Nevada versus Rainbow that in order for a party to attack the validity of an arbitration award, it has a burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence the basis for the statutory ground that they seek to challenge that award. In this case, it's clear that the respondents, the union, has not met that burden of clear and convincing evidence, and the district court simply went beyond its very limited scope and reviewed this matter in a more plenary or de novo type manner. As far as dishonesty, that discussion took place in the court order in terms of the arbitrary capricious, and the court exceeded its limited review by looking to the merits of the arbitrator's case and finding that it simply disagrees with Arbitrator Cohen that Ms. White was dishonest. First, in its order, the lower court states that it concurs with the union during oral arguments at that stage, that dishonesty must have an element of intent as asserted by the union. The lower court sees fit to go ahead and the rest of the order talk about there's no finding of intentional dishonesty, and the district is still not sure what intentional dishonesty means or how that's defined by the court. But that's in spite of Arbitrator Cohen clearly articulating in his award what he is using for the standard of dishonesty. And at the joint exhibit, page 86, he talks about an untruthful finding requires preponderant proof of a willful misstatement or omission of a material fact. There's some intent in there. There's a willfulness.
Mr. Reich, if I may, with respect to the finding of dishonesty, was the arbitrator finding it was dishonest in the way in which she actually used the funds, the allegation of a misuse of funds, or finding that she was less credible in her answers in response to that? Do you understand my question?
I do. And, Your Honor, I believe that both. I believe quite clearly she was not forthright in her responses in her investigatory due process meeting. She wasn't responsive in the arbitration proceeding. And I believe that what Arbitrator Cohen was saying was that a person with this type of competence knew that this student activity fund manual was there and then said never saw it until the date she was interviewed. Meanwhile, she had seen it in 2009 when she was trained, 2011-12 when there was an audit. It was emailed to her during another training, and then another 12-13 audit. So I think what the arbitrator is getting at is her continual reflecting, I do not recall, I never saw it before, I don't know, goes to her credibility of being truthful in her responses at the investigation and in the arbitration. But as well, she knew after the first audit that she was not to sign checks that needed two signatures. She knew that she wasn't to be giving gift cards, wasn't to be buying alcohol, that the school was to comply with the Student Activity Fund manual, and she signed off saying, that's what we'll do. But come to find out, that pattern continued, and she completed the same type of tasks that were not or were prohibited by the manual. So the answer is both. I believe the arbitrator is seeing that she's not credible, was not truthful in her responses, and some of those responses go back to actually her behavior of continuing to violate the manual. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
So this intentional dishonesty continued, but there's no definition in the collective bargaining agreement. There's no definition under the scheme in NRS 391 that defines dishonesty, or intentional dishonesty is defined by the lower court, which I'm not sure, again, what that is. But without an outright prohibition on the arbitrator to define what honesty is in the CBA or NRS, the arbitrator is free to come up with that interpretation of dishonesty as he saw fit. This was discussed by the United States District Court of Nevada in Underwood versus Palms Place LLC, and finding that when there is no prohibition in the contract, or they were talking about a number of contracts, there is supported by substantial evidence in the record that he had the ability to make this determination on dishonesty. Now, second, the district court exceeded its limited scope of review regarding the arbitrary and capricious standard altogether. In the Clark County Education Association Isabella Stewart case against the Clark County School District, this court holds that the arbitrary and capricious standard does not permit a reviewing court to vacate an arbitrator's award based on a misinterpretation of law or fact. Rather, such review is limited to whether the arbitrator's findings are supported by substantial evidence in the record. The court holds that substantial evidence is defined as evidence that a reasonable mind might accept as adequate to support a conclusion. Now, I'm obligated to tell the court when I was reviewing my briefs and case law for this argument, I realized there was a failure to cite case law regarding the definition of the substantial evidence. And for the record, I'd like to point out that the court found in Whitemain versus Anaskovich, 124 Nevada 302 at page 308, 183 P3rd at 137 page 141, which was a 2008 case, which has been cited to you by other cases in the state. Furthermore, this court holds that an arbitrator's award must be upheld even in the presence of erroneous findings of fact. Here, the lower court is not authorized to reweigh the evidence presented to the arbitrator and then come up with its own findings. They are limited that so long as...
Is that what you think happened here with the district court? Where do you see that in the district court's order?
Well, where I see that, Your Honor, is, first of all, there was no definition of substantial evidence, just that the court found there was substantial evidence. Mm-hmm. There was no definition that a reasonable mind might accept the record as presented that it could support this award. I mean, the court is entitled to its opinion, but it's not the only opinion, and it's not the opinion that mattered in this case. The opinion based on the evidence, the almost 400 pages of the arbitration transcript, the closing briefs, the exhibits, was Arbitrator Cohn's opinion on what that meant. And it was reasonable. And unless his interpretation of that evidence is palpably irrational or way outside any type of rationality, it should be upheld by the district court.
Is it your position that the district court undertook a credibility assessment of the witnesses in this case and arrived at different conclusions based on that approach?
Oh, I do. And it was clear in the order that the court on joint exhibit pages 840 to 841, the court in its order takes particular snippets and excerpts of the arbitration award and then says there's no finding of dishonesty here. There's not substantial evidence. And if the court had gone another couple pages in the arbitration award, it would have found that it is very well laid out how the arbitrator came with his factual underpinnings of finding dishonesty based on the record. So I think, yes, I think the court was looking at the transcripts and looking at the evidence based on his order and then came up with its own findings to say they found intentional dishonesty.
You have 2:30 left. You want to reserve?
I will reserve.
Okay.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Devin Reese for the record, counsel for the respondent, Kara White, as well as the Washoe School Principals Association. It's always a privilege and an honor to be in this building. I want to start by a discussion of some of the facts which I think are relevant to ultimately a determination, and not because I think that this court's role is to rehash or reexamine facts, but because I think what is often lost when we come before a court of appeals at any level is sort of a mystified view that those facts don't matter. But at the end of the day, real people's lives were affected. Kara White was an outstanding principal, was an outstanding employee of the school district for 17 years. And in the course of a very limited period of time, her life was irrevocably changed because of that. Fortunately, we have an excellent decision from Judge Freeman, who concluded that the decision by the arbitrator, who had picked up this file cold and looked at it, was wrong. And now the question is, what do we do with that? How does the court evaluate? What are the standards by which the court does? But at its core, we're sitting under a seal here that says, do justice. And that's what I'm asking for this court to do, is to continue the justice that was done by Judge Freeman and to find that Justice that Kara White was in fact entitled to a finding that her job should not have been placed in jeopardy.
Mr. Reese, I think one is always respectful of the fact that these cases impact people's lives. Most assuredly, the three justices on this panel are as well. But we are also bound by legal principles. One of those, as a starting point, is the standard of review. So would you agree that the standard of review by this panel is as outlined by counsel for appellant in a case in which there has been arbitration? Well, we're not in a position to assess the credibility determinations made by the arbitrator, are we?
Your Honor, I believe your standard review today is a de novo standard review. You've got to look at the things that are in front of you and come to your own conclusions. I believe this panel will do that. I don't believe that Judge Freeman was making different credibility determinations. Of course, there is this general preference in the law that says we defer to arbitrators. And the question is, why do we do that, right? Our case law says the reason why we do that, especially in the context of labor law, is because we presume that arbitrators have a specialized knowledge about labor law. Sometimes it's industry, sometimes it's the actual unions in front of them, that allows them to be different than maybe a general jurisdiction court. And that really is the underpinnings of it. It's not this general claim that arbitrations are a preferred vehicle for dispute resolution. They are. But the reason why we specifically in labor context do that is because we believe that those people, maybe a man or a woman, have a specialized knowledge in the area of labor. The problem with that is that it presumes then that our district court would never have the ability to challenge or overturn the decision that an arbitrator made. And I don't believe that's right. I think our statutory framework, both under the Uniform Arbitration Act as well as the case law from this court, have made it clear that there are cases where it is so overwhelming or so egregious that a decision by an arbitrator must be overturned. This is one of those cases. I've been privileged to practice in the state for nearly 20 years, and twice I've asked a district court to vacate an arbitrator's award. Only one time have I gotten that person to agree to it. Rather than the parade of horribles that the school district believes will happen, where the floodgates of litigation will happen and people will be arbitrating in the streets, I don't think that's true. That means that we have some limited deferral to the arbitrator's reasoning, but it doesn't mean that they have carte blanche to ignore what is the overwhelming amount of evidence or to misapply the law. And Judge Freeman's order is excellent. It is very specific. It walks through the various elements required for how a trial court exercises their jurisdiction and discretion in looking at what an arbitrator does, and then he makes conclusions that, in fact, this was not legally tenable. And he does so on two grounds. First, he talks about the legal basis, which is the idea that 18.1 in the parties' collective bargaining agreement is a substitute for the statutory framework that's identified in 391. That's the first thing. And then he goes later on to say that even if that were not the case, I would also have concluded that the weight of evidence does not support the finding. Meaning, I think it's possible that two people look at the same set of evidence and find different conclusions, but our court system is premised on the idea that a district court looking at this information has the experience and knowledge to know the difference between the two. Meaning he can make a decision that it's not a credibility determination, but that arbitrator Cohen heard evidence and ignored the weight of it. That's not the same thing as saying, I didn't think this person did X, Y, or Z. And so when you look at it, I think the school district's counsel has repeatedly said, well, arbitrator Cohen looked at 4 days worth of testimony, and he wants you to visually see a stack of paper, right? And my point to that is, arbitrator Cohen disregarded the testimony of 8 witnesses. Certainly, there was compelling evidence that was contradictory, and he said, this doesn't pass the smell test. And I think that's ultimately what you're asking district courts to do in that very rare instance when they would select to vacate an award, both based on the law, which, as you said, Justice Hardesty, is one of the critical things that certainly this panel will do, and also understanding what the factual underpinnings of that were.
Well, as you noted, the panel here is responsible for looking at the arbitrator's decision de novo. So give me an example of a statement made by the arbitrator that you believe is not supported by substantial evidence.
I think what I would do is not necessarily a statement. I have the arbitration award and we could look at it, but it would be the things which are ignored. There is testimony from a prior arbitrator's decision, Arbitrator Halter, which was considered, in which he found that Principal White was honest. Her testimony had an indicia of veracity. There was the testimony of Debbie Martino, who is an educator and administrator in the district, who said Miss White was, I've known her for nearly 17 years, I've been in the district 40 years, and I think the things that she's been accused of were not the kinds of things that would be salacious or untruthful or unprofessional. There's Principal Fusen at Spanish Springs. There's Principal Hansen. All of these educators came in and testified that these things that happened with Principal White were accounting oversight or communication problems. Not that they had any relationship to someone who was actively trying to seek out or deceive or be untruthful. And so those are the kind of things. I can't justify this arbitrator's decision because, of course, I don't agree with it. I don't think that he was right. But that's not ultimately what Judge Freeman was having to make an assessment of. He first assessed the legal issue, and secondarily, he asked the question about substantial evidence. And he said that the substantial evidence just simply did not exist. I think it's also a very unique thing that happened in this particular case, and I think it's worth thinking about, and that is this particular arbitrator never heard testimony. It wasn't live testimony. He literally picked up the transcript of 4 days worth of arbitration and made determinations based on that. And I'm sorry, the point of this is that you cannot make truthfulness claims or credibility claims in a vacuum. And that's ultimately what happened in a way that was detrimental to Ms. White. And I think the court is certainly understandable that you are concerned about upsetting the apple cart with arbitrations. But at the end of the day, those cases are so very rare that this is the case that is in front of you and is the one which challenges that question.
Let me ask you this question, turning to another subject, as to the court's finding that the arbitrator exceeded his authority. Specifically, if you would address 391.3116 as it applies to 18.1 of the collective bargaining agreement. I mean, I don't think there's any question there.
Your Honor, my opinion is that in the cases where parties collectively bargain for a different disciplinary proceeding or procedure, that supersedes it. So 391.3116 specifically excludes from its purview those school principals that have a contract which covers that. And it is apparent to me that although our arbitrator in this case dropped a footnote and sort of half-heartedly acknowledged its existence, he chose to wash away the protections of the party's collective bargaining agreement by his own claim that Ms. White's truthfulness or lack of truthfulness washed away the protections of 18.1 of the party's collective bargaining agreement. I think Judge Freeman was correct and very specific about the findings there, finding that the reason why the Cohen Award could be vacated was that there was an error of law fundamental to the parties.
Just Stiglitz. I guess to come back with what I asked counsel, a little bit just about the arbitrator's finding of dishonesty, and I'm wrestling with whether it's based on the conduct for which she was noticed, because the conduct for which she was noticed was spending in violation, not stealing, but using the funds for not approved purposes. All the money was accounted for, requiring the teachers, or at least the allegation that she required the teachers to use their own time to do the mandatory training. So that was the conduct which would certainly lend itself to progressive discipline under ordinary circumstances. I guess the question is, I'm trying to determine, did the arbitrator find the malfeasance as opposed to the misfeasance in her responses, which is not the notice conduct for which she's being disciplined? That's where I'm, when I read the arbitrators and Justice Hardesty had asked where, you know, where do we deal with this? That's what I'm wrestling. Is he punishing her because he did not like her answers? Or is he punishing her for the conduct for which she was noticed?
I don't want to presume to know what another person thought. As I read the arbitration award, there is a curious difference between those things. At the end of the day, I come down on the side of my client, Kara White, who I think gave the best answer she could, given the questions that were posed, and understand that I was not representing Principal White during the underlying arbitration. And so it's hard for me to give you a credibility determination. The conduct she was noticed for was, as you've indicated, these allegations of impropriety, whether it be with the SAF funds or the GLAAD training. And that ultimately is, I think, a problem. It's a disconnect between the arbitrator's decision and ultimately the award, which I think Judge Freeman gives the best way to bridge that, which is an analysis of the totality of the information and evidence, and this claim that this washing away could somehow erode the substantive rights of that would be given due process issues with the principal's contract as it existed. So at the end of the day, I'm not sure it matters one way or the other. I do think that it sort of creates another avenue on which this court could affirm Judge Freeman's decision, because it really points out that there is a difference between appearing not credible through the written transcript that said, well, I'm not sure or I don't recall, or the untruthfulness that came with the underlying act. And I think you could disconnect those, and you could also say Judge Freeman was in the best position to evaluate that and analyze that question. At the end of the day, I'm not sure we'll know, but it's yet another reason why the Cohen Award is arbitrary, capricious. If it had been more specific, maybe we wouldn't be here. Maybe we would have the ability to discern which of those elements of truthfulness were really being attacked. But again, because the decision is sort of written in the way it is and the way the outcome is, I suppose it's best left to justices like yourself to answer the question. I want to sort of close by thinking about this question of what happens to us as we go forward. And I think that this case is an example of one in which we're able to think about the way in which we want our school teachers, our principals, to do the good work that they do. Kara White was a principal who was recognized for turning around troubled schools. And the question is, what due process rights do we anticipate that those people receive when they find themselves in a grievance or an arbitration process? And I think it really, for me, sums up the concern that I have, which is we want judges in our Second Judicial District Court to have the power to look at and review the decisions that are made by arbitrators. How far they go with that is certainly something that this court has seen fit to place limits on. And I can tease out words out of various cases that make it sound like I'm right. But at the end of the day, I think that that's your job as justices on our highest court to suss out where are the cases where these things happen. And I trust that that will happen. I trust that that is the way that this court sees itself. And so my client is thankful for the opportunity to be here. Certainly I'm humbled to be here and will await your decision. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
To be clear, I reserved 5 minutes in the beginning. Am I now at 7:27 or am I at 2:27?
2:23.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I want to just address some of those arguments in reverse. First, to Justice Stiglitz, I'm clear on what your question is. And I think in the award, it was very clear what the arbitrator was finding dishonesty on. And it's the same scenario that the district brought the dishonesty charges, because when they wanted to speak to Ms. White on March 7th and March 22nd, it was regarding all the failures with the student activity fund and the inappropriate expenditures and all those things. It was at those investigatory due process meetings where Ms. White did not recall the manual. And this is after seeing the manual, like I discussed earlier, many times. And In the award, it's Joint Appendix 86, the arbitrator goes at great lengths, and I won't read the whole thing, but it talks about how he came up with dishonesty. It falls into the category of most serious offenses. An employee can be charged with and subjected to discipline, including dismissal for first offenders. And then he outlines the grievance, just too competent a person to forget, that as a result of an audit, speaking for management, he agreed in writing that gift cards would no longer be given to employees, and then goes through alcohol, I don't know if he mentions the alcohol, buying alcohol, but goes through and discusses all the times that she came in contact with this manual. And then when she's called on the carpet that she didn't comply with it, she says, I never saw it before. That's the dishonesty that the arbitrator was looking at.
Well, one thing that strikes me, if I can interrupt you for just a second,
yes.
The 2009 audit that showed that SAFs were being misused, and there was an explanation why it was important to the district. It had potential penalties with the IRS and status. And so it seems to me like that's something you would remember.
And the arbitrator hit the nail on the head with that point. This isn't some ministerial activity that was being done. This is something that you would remember. I was called on the carpet. My school was called on the carpet. I signed off saying we wouldn't do these things again. And then, again, seeing it in training again, and then say, I don't recall that. It was too much of a stretch for the arbitrator. That was negligence or mistake. It was that she was being untruthful. And I really do want to just address Justice Perigieri's discussion on 391-3116. In Manner, I want to get the correct site for you. Manner?
I was simply, Justice Stiglitz, I think, has a question for you, if the Chief will allow it.
Go ahead, finish your thought. And
I just wanted to say the Manner Healthcare Center Incorporated case versus Monsieur, 126 Nevada 735. This court holds that a challenging party must provide evidence that not only did it communicate the correct law to the arbitrator, but the arbitrator intentionally and knowingly chose to ignore that law despite the fact it was correct. There must be concrete evidence of an intent to disregard known law in the findings of the arbitrator or in the transcript of proceedings. Nobody even heard of 391-3116 between these parties until the motion to vacate the award was filed. The union never brought it to the attention of the arbitrator. The district never brought it to the attention of the arbitrator. In the harder arbitration, it was never brought up by the parties. Arbitrator Cohen found this 391-3116 in doing his due diligence, and I don't think knew how to apply it appropriately, but knew it was there. And then he decided, after finding the evidence that she was dishonest, whether it's viewed under the terms and scheme of 391 NRS or under the scheme of the contract, there was just cause to terminate her for dishonesty.
Justice Stiglitz has a question.
Yes.
Just to clarify, the 2009 audit, that was not discipline. It didn't result in discipline and in no charges, correct?
That's correct.
And it wasn't until 2013 that was the first discipline that was allegations.
Correct, because the pattern of behavior continued.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments and your briefing. The case will stand submitted.